Thank you. Thank you. Go with me to Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16, if you need a Bible, raise your hands. We'll give you a Bible, but you want to get a Bible in your hand. So Luke chapter 16, beginning at verse 16. All right, yeah, keep your hand up if you need a Bible, and we've got some upstairs for you. So we're in a series here, middle of a series. You'll notice in the front of your bulletin, actually in the ninth week of it. And the series is called Your Life and Your Calling and Your Work. And the integration of the fact that when you come to Christ, you are called. That is your calling, and now you've been sent by God into the world. And there's no sacred, secular division. There's no compartmentalization. That all of your life is part of your calling, and everyone is. And so we've been unfolding that and expanding it for the last few weeks. And so today, we're going to approach it from a different angle. Now, I've been trying to hit it from all these different angles. Last week, we talked about prudence, and actually, this week's going to build very closely on last week. Of prudence, the same actual chapter. And our theme is generosity. It's really the call to a generous life. And we're going to unpack that this morning. And because the issue of generosity is much, much larger than money. You can give money and not be generous as a person. It's much broader. It's much deeper. It really relates to your vision and your understanding of your identity and your life. And it's very, very difficult to be a generous person over the long haul. Consistently and broadly, and Jesus knows that. And so he tells us this parable, and beginning at verse 16, it's quite a parable. It's unlike last week's message, which was a parable spoken to disciples. This parable is spoken to the Pharisees. And you ever notice there's a lot of passages in the New Testament about the Pharisees? And the reason that is because we're the Pharisees. Those who attend church, you know, are respectable, and we're attending church, we're religious, you know, we're moral. And Jesus consistently went after the Pharisees because he knows how easy it is to even come to Christ, start going to church and reading your Bible, and before you know it, you're a modern-day Pharisee. And so every time we're reading about the Pharisees, you've got to be pointing the finger at yourself. And so when the Pharisees heard last week's message, although they weren't in the room, the text that Jesus talked about of the dishonest steward, and Jesus started talking about money at the end of that passage, it says that the Pharisees in verse 14, they loved money, and they began to sneer at Jesus, which means they showed contempt for him. They thought this was ridiculous. And it says because they loved money. And Jesus just said to them, you can't love God and money at the same time. And so now, well, Jesus then, he speaks this parable. But this parable is spoken to them, Pharisees. And it's really like, and actually, it's interesting, this is chapter 16. The parable in chapter 15, right before this, the prudent man, the dishonest steward, is the parable of the prodigal son. In the end of chapter 15. And if you remember the parable, remember the younger brother who runs away from home and the father welcomes him back. That's the love of the father who kisses him and embraces him. But the Pharisees are the elder brother. They're in the house, you know, they're sons, but they're not experiencing the love of God. They're not, they're watching. They're cold, they're indifferent, they're angry, resentful, you know, kind of like us, you know, and touchy. But they're not experiencing the generous love of God, nor are they generous themselves. They're very much locked up. And it's not easy to be a Christian in New York, is it? You take hits along the way. So I hear comments like this often. You know, Pete, I life has worn me down. You know, I did have fire once, but I've been ripped off so many times by people. Or I gave myself to people, but I was not appreciated. No one said thank you. And so now, you know what? I pick and choose, Pete, who I will be generous to. I am selective. I am discerning. I am prophetic, you know. But really, it's pure suspicion. But Jesus knows how easily we can get cranky and critical and cold and hard-hearted. And we believe one thing in our heads, but we live another. And so this parable is like a bomb. It's like an earthquake written to, you know, Pharisees, to us. It's a heavy parable, but it's meant to challenge you and move you. In fact, it's meant to change your life and the way that you orchestrate your life and the way you see your life and calling and around this issue of generosity. And so you'll make some changes. But this make no question about it. This is meant to be an earthquake event when you read it and you ponder it. And I've been around people who have experienced earthquakes in California. They say it's amazing when you're walking, all of a sudden the earth is shaking. And everything you held to be true is now up for grabs. And that's really what this parable is meant to be. It's like an earthquake, like, whoa, this is real Christianity, and give yourself to take a good hard look at your life. And so we're going to read the text, and I'll make a couple comments as we're reading it. And at the end of the message, we're going to have 3 to 5 minutes of pure silence before God to allow it to sink in. And then we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper together. So we're going to have hopefully an experience of God's generosity out of which it can flow out of us, all right? So let's begin reading in chapter 16 of verse 19 in the book of Luke. And it reads as follows. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. Let me stop right here for a minute. Let me comment. This guy was very wealthy and basically making the point that he was every day celebrating. He was overdoing it in terms of opulence and affluence, very careless about it. He's got these purple clothes on, which be like kind of like he shops all at designer clothing, all right? He's got all tailored suits and the very best. So he's extremely wealthy, this guy, as it starts out. And then verse 20, at his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up, and he saw Abraham far away, with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he's comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all that, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. And he answered, Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have 5 brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment. And Abraham replied, That they have Moses and the prophets. Let him listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. And he says to them, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. Wow. Quite a parable. And so here you've got these two extremes. You've got this wealthy rich man, and then you've got Lazarus, who is basically, and it's the only time in the New Testament when Jesus tells a parable and a person's name is used. Remember that. It's very important. He's named Lazarus. And apparently he's been dumped at the door. That's what the original Hebrew word gives you, the indication. They carried him at some gate. The gate is either at the rich man's house or it's at the gate of a city. We're not sure. But nonetheless, the rich man passes him. And so he's impatiently dumped off there where he's crippled and he begs all day. Now, the guy is so weak that he's got sores all over his body. Ulcer, some kind of sores, and he's unable to protect himself, and so you've got these half-wild dogs floating around licking the sores off of him. So it's quite a picture there. But apparently, Lazarus is a Christian. He's a faithful servant of God, and so they both die, and Lazarus ends up in heaven. And again, remember, this is a parable, so it's not meant to be taken literally, all the details, because there's a whole lot of, he's seen at Abraham's side, which is considered the highest place of heaven and bliss, and so he's there and in Abraham's bosom, and the rich man's in hell, in Hades, in torment. And so the rich man's looking at the situation. He sees Lazarus at a distance, and he calls out, you know, Father Abraham. And he's kind of calling in all his cars, like, hey, I'm one of you. I'm a believer too. Father Abraham, you know, give me a hand here. And he shouts. And basically Abraham says, no, the chasm is too great. And so I don't want to go into a whole big discursus on hell here, but he's begging for relief. And hell, you know, hell, as many pictures given of hell in the New Testament and this literal fire. But remember, when the Bible talks about hell, it's referring to separation from God, the complete absence of God. And so when the Bible's speaking about eternal realities like heaven and hell, it has to use human words to explain something that's really unexplainable with our vocabulary. And so I really believe this is an image of the horrificness of being separated from God. And it was interesting, because I had a young person come to me last week, actually, and just struggling with the whole notion of hell. How can God send people to hell and all that? And we just talked about a couple of things. You know, one is that you know, first of all, we never judge anybody. We don't ever determine who's in hell and who's not. That is God's job. You know, he is judge. And so I never get sucked into, oh, Hitler's in hell and he's in hell. I say, you know what? I don't know. I'm not God. I'm just Pete. You know, I'm just trying to work out my own salvation in fear and trembling right now. And so leave him alone and leave everybody alone. Every time, oh, you know, just don't get into that. God is the judge and we are not to touch that and go near that. And I just know God is good and God is loving and God will do what's right. But I do know this, that God gives people what they choose. And the invitation of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of history, is God loves you and God's longing for you. God's reaching out to you and me. And he invites us to a love relationship. But he is not going to force himself down your throat. He is not going to put a gun to your head. And so if a person chooses, I don't want to be with God. God says, I give you your wish. It's your desire. God's not going to force you to be with him forever. That would be your hell. But make no mistake about it. If you've read human history, and if you've lived a little bit longer, you know there is demonic evil in the world. And I thank God there is a judgment of demonic evil, but I'll leave that to God. And you read things like Rwanda and Bosnia and the Holocaust and things going on right now in the Congo and other places in the world. I mean, there is real evil, and God will judge it. But I just leave that all to him. And so that's my little side course. But you got the drift. All right, so here's this rich man, and he's there in hell. And he's like, okay, listen, all right, now save my brothers. I got five brothers. And so if you could resurrect Lazarus from the dead, they'll believe. You ever think that? I'd really have faith if just God would do a great miracle for me. I'll have tremendous faith. Or if I say, if only someone could witness to my uncle, he'd definitely become a Christian. Or if he could see God do something tremendous, like actually literally, you know, heal a blind man, he'll become a Christian. And Jesus makes the point, no, he will not. Because the issue is not seeing miracles has never changed people. And you had the experience of watching people experience miracles, get healed from cancer dramatically. They still don't become Christians sometimes because the issue is heart. And Jesus says, I don't believe scripture. Just like you haven't believed it, rich man. You've been going to synagogue your whole life. Neither will they. And Jesus does not go down that road because the critical issue to melt a stony heart, okay, requires brokenness. And the man's in hell not because he's rich. The man is in hell because he has a hard heart that's not moved. Abraham was rich, okay, and he did fine. So here's the issue. Here's the text, all right? And today's message is, your calling, we've talked about here, is your whole life, right? It's all of your life. You go to work tomorrow, as Rosie said last week, I'm in full-time ministry and I'm a lawyer, right? I'm in full-time ministry, I'm a at-home mom. I'm in full-time ministry and I'm a teacher. And your calling is your whole life, right? That's been our theme here, whether it's your personal life, spending time with God, your family's part of your calling, if you're married or single, and they're your first neighbor, in the political realm as you engage in government, and at your workplace tomorrow, you're in full-time ministry. You're called by God there, and you're working that out, and your neighborhood with your neighbors, and in church here, you're in full-time ministry. We're all in full-time ministry. You're called by God. When you accepted Christ, you're sent by him. Now, to grasp this calling, you have to, that generosity is to permeate all those areas. And that's why this parable is so important, because you see, this rich man did not have a generous heart. And now he was a Pharisee, which means he tithed. He gave 10% of his money. But it's not simply about giving money. Now we're going to talk about money in a few minutes. It's much deeper than that. Okay, it's a generous heart. So what I'd like to do this morning is unpack it a little bit. And that I know we need to get to God experientially together because it's something God must do deep within us. Because it's a life that permeates us. We're different than everybody else around us. We've not been jaded. We are not to let ourselves get cold or indifferent, but we're to wrestle, you know, with what it looks like for us. So I'm going to give you three primary points. I actually had five at 8 o'clock this morning, and I got rid of two. So let me just unpack it as best I can in generosity, what it looks like. Now, the word generosity comes from the word grace, which means I'm giving a gift. And of unmerited favor. I'm giving a gift to someone who doesn't deserve it. It's not based on a person's performance. It's not based on what they do for me. I'm getting nothing back. So my family was generous growing up. We were generous if you were good and you're in the family. We were very generous inside certain bounds, especially if you were born in Naples. If you were born in Sicily, you're out, okay? But we would consider ourselves very generous, but it was that's not generosity in the biblical sense of the word. The biblical sense, it's a heart of unmerited favor. It just is who you are towards all. And so it really, you know, it starts with this issue of, it's really ultimately about, it's about giving of yourself, your person. I like John Paul II, it's got to me the best definition, love in a word or generosity in a word, it's the gift of self. And let me just try to illustrate this, and then we'll go back to the rich man. There's just a true story, and it's about a young married couple, Peter and Sharon, and they have two young kids at home, and Peter has to travel a lot for his job. And so, but she's anxious and often gets depressed raising these kids alone. And so on a Monday morning, he gets up early, he's got to take a plane to New York City, and he calls up from the airport, Sharon, how you doing? And he can hear in her voice, you know, she's anxious, and she's already sliding down. And but she's trying to cover up and all that. So make a long story short, they hang up, and he calls his boss, you know, and he comes home. And about an hour later, and she's there at the kitchen table. She's already cried, you know, fixing the kids' Cheerios. And he walks in the room, and she's like, screams, you know, what are you doing here, you know? And you're losing your job and your meetings. And he basically said, listen, honey, you need me more than New York does. And I called my boss. I told him I'm taking a few days off. They'll be fine. And so he ends up kneeling down, helping the kids get dressed, takes them, you know, to the park with her. But the point is he gave of himself, something he wanted, you know, something he loved with his job, and he focused on his wife and his daughters. And his wife wrote about that, about this whole generosity thing of just who he is. And I think it captures it, of this giving of self. Because, you see, the rich man doesn't give himself. I don't know what's going on in the rich man's mind. I mean, I don't know about you, but I pass homeless people pretty much every day. I don't know about your neighborhood, but I sometimes think I should move to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They probably don't have as many, you know. It'd be a lot easier and simpler. I don't have to deal with this stuff. But so I don't know what's going on in the rich man's mind about this guy. What are his thoughts? You know, maybe he's thinking the poor Lazarus is here. And he knows Lazarus's name. He's here because he made some bad moves. You know, he got himself in the situation. If I help him out, I'm just enabling his dysfunction. I'm perpetuating it. So I don't know the answer to that question. And I'm not saying I know what you should do and we should do with all the people around us in tremendous need, because we are surrounded. But I do know, and some of you have overfunctioned, and we have some, I know we have a percentage in this room that you used to give a lot of yourself and you lost yourself because you didn't have a self. And so I know you've got to pull this in. And work out balance and boundaries and all that, but not at the same time to put up a wall and grow cold of heart. But the key thing is this rich man walks right by Lazarus, goes in, he eats, he drinks, he parties. You know, he doesn't kick Lazarus as he passes. He doesn't call the police and say, get this bum, you know, off my property. But it never dawns on him, at least. It never gets in that at least I've got to do something about this or wrestle with it. And even I call the authorities, but I'm actually moved to some compassion here. I'm concerned about it. He just basically does what everybody else does, which is nothing, all his neighbors. You see, it's not that he's rich. That misses the point of the parable, because it's not wrong to have money and have wealth, but it's wrong to make it the end of your existence. And it's not wrong to want to have a secure future financially and a pleasant future. It's not wrong to enjoy the good things of life. Jesus himself, we talked about a few weeks ago in Zacchaeus, Jesus himself was called a glutton, all right, then a drunkard, and he clearly was able to enjoy the good things of life. He turns water into 180 gallons of the best wine at Cana, and we see him enjoying $45,000 worth of perfume poured on his feet, and so he's able to enjoy wealth, okay, and so he's not a pure ascetic by any means. But the issue for this rich man is his heart is hard. He's absorbed. He's swamped in his own life. He's got all this stuff going on, and he misses the vision of his life. Just like it's so easy for us to miss the vision of our lives, which is our vision, our calling, is to be generous, is to give of ourselves, which is the essence of why God made us, as he gave him to us. And so it's not just giving the guy a few bucks. It's somehow, what does it look like to give this guy, get involved with this guy or give him my life and somehow take some action. It's our lives that we're talking about. We talk about, I'm a generous person. The question is, that is your life one of my life is a gift for other folks? Salvation is a gift, right? It's by grace alone, through the work of Jesus alone. It's received by faith alone. But true faith works itself out in generosity, in mercy, in love. And if it doesn't work out in mercy and generosity, Jesus says it's not true faith. There's nothing there. It's like Calvin and Luther used to write about, yes, salvation is by grace, but as the parable of the sheep and goats tells us in Matthew 25 and this parable, if that faith in God does not become love and generosity, it is not true faith. It's dead. It's worthless. And true faith leads to generosity. So that's number one. Just hold on to this idea of giving of self as you think of, do I give generously of myself to people? And but then number two, it's really the question of giving time. I think this is the biggest issue for us in our culture because the Western society, who has time? I don't have time. And I'd rather give you money. It's easier. But time. When I give time, it's a portion of my life. And so the challenge is we all have very limited time, right? I mean, between sleeping and work and things of life. I mean, how do I juggle all this? And that's the great question. But the ability to sit with a child and, you know, listen to them or a friend and their day, it's a gift. This, to me, has probably been, I mean, giving of myself and giving of my time has been a great challenge. And not judging people quickly. You know, it's very easy to judge people quickly, isn't it? Just make a, and not be kind and not be generous and give it time and listen to the other side of the story. But even with Jerry, it's easier to buy her some flowers and stop at the supermarket. And here, it takes me about 10 minutes and costs me a little bit of money. That's easy. It's quick. But to actually, like, get out a cookbook and, like, cook a meal and shop for the food, figure out what I'm doing, gotta cook it, gotta clean up. I mean, I'd rather just buy the flowers. And I'm married 25 years, and the problem is the flower thing doesn't work real good because she knows. And it's really hit me, you know, that it's just so easy. I realize my own hardness of something that she has requested over many years, very difficult for me to do because it's not just out of my comfort zone, it's time. And I just got a lot of things I'm doing. I mean, I got a lot on my mind. I got to prepare my sermon for you, you know? And she wants eggplant, you know what I mean? It's very easy to be stingy with the people that you actually love, the people actually closest to you. I'm amazed at how stingy I can be. I hope my daughters aren't here at the service. Stingy with my own kids. And I say, like I'm sure some of you, I'll do it. If I can only get through this month, this deadline, this set of commitments, I promise you, I will be generous, oh God, and I'll use my time well. And I like Ann Dillard, she has this great saying, she's a writer, she says, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. And so I've been pondering this now for weeks, realizing, you know, if I'm not generous today, this is my life, and I'm just not generous. And I'm kidding myself, saying I am, but I'm not. And I just been asking myself about generosity of self and time, and I've been doing this now for a couple of weeks. And you cannot believe how convicting it is. And it's not even a lot of time. Yes, it's managing all the things I've got going on, but it's really a heart of my life is one as I've received great love and generosity from God, and I give it to others. And so I've had a goal, and I throw this out to you, is just even having one quality conversation a day with a person. Just a quality conversation where, because we're generous when we give somebody our full attention when they speak. Someone's speaking, you're actually not doing three other things. Your mind's not somewhere else. You're actually there. It's such a gift of yourself. The sad thing is, as many folks tell me, I have to pay a therapist, Pete, for them to give me a gift of time because no one has it. And, I mean, God bless therapists. But we, of all the people on earth, because we've been so loved, we are our calling at work when everyone's judging people and gossiping and triangling and everyone's speeding and trying to get one over on somebody else and holding back knowledge and opportunities. We're not like that because, you know, our hands are in a different place. And so we give ourselves, we give our time. But there's the issue of money, and there is some money involved. And what's interesting, while this guy, the Pharisee, they do give money. They're very meticulous. Money is an issue, and it's still there, and it is a great indicator, as we talked about last week in early in this chapter. I read a book recently that was written by two sociologists, Christian Smith and Michael Emerson. They're probably the two most well-known sociologists, Christians, out of Notre Dame and University of North Carolina. And they wrote a book, it's called Passing the Plate, Why American Christians Don't Give Away More Money. And there's massive sociological study of American Christianity, because they had found out that over the 20th century, since the year 1900, while income has gone up among American Christians, the percentage of giving has gone down in the United States. And they began fascinated by trends. And they were trying to figure out what's really the data and how did this happen. So I'm going to throw out to you a couple of their conclusions, because it's just so fascinating to look at, because it's important for us. So here's what they said. Number one, they said one of five American Christians, they said 20% in the United States, give literally nothing to any charity, church, or parachurch. That's a pretty big percentage. Non-Christian religious believers give about the same amount as evangelicals, about 3%. Only about 12% of evangelicals, Christians, actually tithe, which would be giving away 10% of their income. And it's not, again, not that different from wealthy non-religious people. And again, it mentioned how even in books like The Automatic Millionaire by David Bach, I mentioned last week, a secular book, they encourage tithing like crazy for secular people, because it builds up wealth and to give to other people, because the more you give, the more you end up having. And it's just fascinating how they said it's interesting how there's more of a movement among secular people, business people, about this idea of tithing and giving your money away, and thus you structure your life around that, than they said even in churches. They went after pastors. I'll skip that chapter. They went after, they said, we're all hung up ourselves, and we're part of the big problem. And they said, the more income you make, they said, the statistics are very clear, the less percentage you give. Very clear statistic. It was very fascinating, than people of lower income. And then the question they asked was, why are American Christians so remarkably stingy? They figured it out. And again, they're comparing it also with the rest of the world. And here's what they said, quote, the first and most formidable rival to generous financial giving of American Christians, which feeds selfishness and stinginess, is America's mass consumerism. Because the whole economy is built on consumerism. What happens is, Christians don't start from the fact of, okay, minimally, I'm giving this 10% away to God. I'm my whole life, and then I adjust my life around that. What Christians do, just like the rest of the culture, they're buying and making commitments. So even if they're making $200,000 a year, they make certain commitments that now they have no money left over. And they bring out all these stats about how even wealthy people feel like they're poor because they're overextended. And so there is no money to give because they started from a starting point of these other commitments have wrapped up in society, and thus they have nothing to give. It was a fascinating study. And I do really believe, and I said it last week, I do believe 10% is a minimal goal for every person, rich, poor, students. I had some students come to me last week. You know, it was wonderful coming. I appreciated you coming to me. I only make $45 a week, Pastor Beach, you know. And because this issue of giving is and tithing and saying, no, I'm going to be a generous person with my life, you then build your life after that. But you set that from the top. It's in stone. It's impacting your spirituality because you respect the power of money will suck you down and the world. I like what C.S. Lewis once wrote. He says, if your giving does not pinch you or hamper you, he says, you're giving too small. There ought to be things that you would like to do and that you cannot do because of what you give to charity. In other words, because your life is first, my life's about generosity. Listen, this is so important we teach our children, our teenagers, especially those who are parents, our kids pick up from us. Listen, think about this. In the United States, most teenagers... Teenagers, without any maturity or skill or insight, they can get a credit card, they can go to the supermarket, they can get to community college of their choice. They live under a government, the United States of America, which has saved them out of poverty. And teenagers here in the United States, they have vast power when you compare them to their counterparts in other countries. In some very poor countries, where teenagers are probably smarter, more industrious, and better human beings, perhaps. That wasn't meant to be a slam. Perhaps. But the point is, the fact that our teenagers have the good fortune to live in the United States of America is pure grace. It's pure grace. And so, I was reading about Haiti the other day, and if two people in Haiti, say they're a married couple, they want to save and buy some land. Do you know they have to go? It's going to take them 19 years to get a permit to buy that land? Things we take for granted. The unemployment rate is 80% in that country. So, do you understand the prosperity, yes, does require hard work, But at the bottom of it all, it's all a matter of grace and a gift. That's why for us to be teaching our teenagers, it's so critical that they get a sense of, my life is to be generous. My life, unlike the rich man in this parable, is not about me. It's not about me and my life and accumulating and I'm busy. No, my calling is to a generous life. Now, not saying it's not complicated when you're surrounded by needs and how do I sort that out and limits and am I, you know, not lose myself and I only got limited time and limited resource and how do I be wise? Yes, those are all the big questions, aren't they? But I understand that my calling, like this rich man who missed it, is to a generous life. It's to Lazarus. It's not this obscure, I know people, I'm committed to the poor, but they're stingy as you can be. Not just, not maybe financially. Like, I'm not bad. I'm pretty good with the money piece. I'm not as good at the self and time piece. And I know I'm not as good at the judgmental piece. You may not know this about me. But, you know, I can write people, I can make a judgment really quick that's negative. And I'm not generous. I'm saying maybe she's like this. I don't know her story. And maybe I should be generous and hold off on making a judgment call on that coworker. And so I've been very convicted about generosity. But I don't know what yours may be. And I could go on about abilities, you know, being generous with your abilities. Some of you have all kinds of abilities, whether it's administration or taxes or nursing or raising children or mentoring or teaching or trades or handyman. You know what? Giving counsel and just using you're generous with your abilities and not so stingy about them. I was reading about a young couple, 65. They retired. They moved for 13 years. They've been in Southeast Asia teaching English as a second language. They just wanted to be generous with the rest of their lives, and they're living off their Social Security, and they're happy as can be. You know what? The rich man missed it. I want you to hear this. It's very easy to live in America, in North America as a Christian, and totally miss your calling. Your calling is to a generous life. And this parable is meant to shock you. It's meant to pull a rug out from you and say, you know what? Look at yourself for a second. Now, I'm going to tell you, I don't know if you know, but there's a famous woman, and I relate to her, actually, and I hope you can relate to her a little bit. The most famous stingy woman in American history, her name was Hetty Green. And she was early 1900s. She inherited a lot of money. She married into money. And she made a lot of money in her life. Actually, she's in the Guinness Book of World Records for being the stingiest person in history. Okay. But I'm going to tell you her story because by the grace of God, that's where you're going with a hard heart. And so am I. I mean, I have the capacity to become this. So here's what she saved her money so much that she never turned on the heat or used hot water in her home. She wore one old dress that she changed only after it had worn out. When her son Ned broke his leg, she wouldn't get him the treatment he needed at the hospital, causing him to lose his leg to gangrene. After her husband died and her children left home, she moved repeatedly from one small apartment to another small apartment in different states to avoid paying taxes. In old age, she suffered from a hernia that she refused to have fixed because the operation would have cost her at that time $150. When she died, her net worth was $1.5 billion U.S. Okay, $200 million at that time in 1916. Okay, now, that's good. You got it. That's good. Huh? Wait. And what Jesus is saying here is that the capacity to have a hard heart can happen to any of us. Now, she's pretty extreme, isn't it? But think about it. With the people you're around, at work, at school, and your family, and your friendships, would they actually say, she's a generous person. She's safe. She's kind. Or she's tight-fisted and stingy. And so I have this little test for you. We're going to have a little silence here. And here's a little quiz for you, okay? On a scale of 1 to 5, all right? Let's see how you're doing. We'll close with it. One of my favorite things is to do with family and friends is to spend time with about that one. Number two, I am intentional about using my abilities and talents to help others, not just to make money, but actually help others. Number three, when I talk with someone, I focus my full attention on them. Wow. Generous. Four, I enjoy giving away at least 10% of my money faithfully and consistently and systematically off the top when a paycheck arrives as my first fruits offering to God. I mean, it's such a joy to me. When one of my possessions is lost, broken, or stolen, it doesn't take me long to let go of it emotionally. I know you talk to a man who's had many a car accident the last 3 months. And lastly, I do not judge people quickly. I'm generous with that. So, how would you score on that one? And here's what I'd like us to do. As I pondered this and what it means for us to slow down our lives, because what Jesus is saying in this parable is, this is a life and death matter. That part of your calling is permeates your, all of your life is to be a generous person. It's fundamental to who you're called to be. So as I ponder this, how do we have a soft heart? How do we not get hard like Hetty Green? Well, I can't tell you, do it, right? Just do it. Man, that'll last about a week, if that. It's going to require receiving, just living in an experience of the love and mercy of God. So if anything Christianity is, it's about a direct experience with God, direct personal contact with the living God. When you come to Christ, Christ lives inside of you. How close. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have a 5-minute discipline right now together of silence. You're going to make it. And we're going to be still and silent before the Lord. Now, one of the images in Luke 15 is of the father kissing the son, the prodigal son who comes home. But silence is one of God's primary languages. I don't know if it's possible to sustain a generous life without really cultivating that direct personal contact with God, who lives inside of you and who's also outside of us. Because when I'm silent, it cleanses my heart of everything I'm afraid of and all my attachments. And as Henry Nouwen said, it's almost impossible to grow spiritually without silence and solitude. But as Dallas Willard has said, silence and solitude are the two most radical disciplines in the Christian West. And so the whole message of Christianity is God's mercy and generosity. That's what Christianity is. The God of the universe has been generous to you and me. So the degree to which you let that mercy and generosity of God into your heart, you receive it, is the degree to which you're able to give it out. But it requires a life of just receiving his mercy and love. So what I'd like us to do is, I'm inviting you to basically let Jesus love you for 5 minutes. Just let yourself be embraced. Let yourself be hugged. Let yourself be loved. Let yourself be served by God. We're all Lazarus in the parable, you know. We're all that guy by the gate, crippled. But the love of God has picked you up through Jesus, died for you. And he has seated you at his table as a child, as a son, as a daughter. That's a gift of Christianity. So we're going to take 5 minutes. So I want you to get comfortable. Get comfortable. Not too comfortable, but get comfortable. All right? And your mind is probably going to wander, right? And, you know, sometimes we meditate on a verse, but this parable is not a Christianity light. This is not scripture, which is like comfort food. This was a very strong parable. And so I'm going to ask you just to be still before the Lord and just like think of yourself, you're giving your full attention to a person. You're giving your full attention right now to God. And now your mind's going to start going into lunch. I wonder if Pop's Diner French fries went up. Oh, I got to do laundry later. I've got to call my mom. You know, you're thinking all these things you have to do, right? And so what I do when that happens, and it happens, right, is I'm flooded. I just always come back, you know? And, Father, Abba. And I use pictures in my mind, like I picture myself like that picture of the prodigal son and the, you know, just hugging him. The father just hugged me. A hug's a great thing for me. I'm in his presence, and I'm just leaning on his chest. I'm not saying anything. I'm just with him. It's the communion. It's the relationship. It's the love. And so the goal is not to get a word from God. Problem is, when we finally shut up, God does start saying things. And even if it doesn't go well for you in this 5 minutes and your mind is racing like crazy, just the fact that you did it is an expression of dependence and humility. And God gives grace to the humble, but he resists the proud. So just the silence. We're creatures, and God, we want to receive your love and your mercy. I want it to come in to me. All right, so I'm going to invite you to take a deep breath, okay? I'm going to get my chair. So here's what we're going to do. I'll be the timekeeper. So for some of you, 5 minutes is going to seem like an hour, all right? So don't fret. I will do 5 minutes. Every time your mind wanders, just come on back. Say, oh, Lord, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Let yourself, he's hugging you, you're hugging him, and you're just leaning on his chest. You're just with him. And you're being still and silent. This is a great gift. But make no mistake about it, if you don't do this very often, this is like running like two laps around a track, and it's going to be a bit challenging, okay? But I'm going to give you a little structure for it. So, all right, take a deep breath, and breathe in, say, oh, Holy Spirit, fill me, God. And just breathe out all your anxieties and fears and worries of today and tomorrow, the Lord says, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him, you know? And so we're just going to be still before the Lord, who's here. And we're waiting on him. We're letting his love come in and fill us and flood us. All right, so let's begin.